हरे हे
In the class one year ahead of Abhay was a very spirited nationalist, Subhash Chandra Bose. He had been a student at Presidency College, but had been expelled for organizing a student strike against a British professor who repeatedly abused Indian students. At Scottish churches, Bose appeared to be a serious student. He was secretary of the philosophy club and was working cooperatively with Vice Chancellor Urquhart. From Subhash Bose and others, Abhay heard talks of Indian independence. He heard the names well known in his native Bengal, Bipin Chandra Pal, who had fought to repeal the Arms Act, Surendranath Banerjee, who startled the British with his agitation against the 1905 partition of Bengal, Lala Lajpat Rai, and most notably Mohandas K. Gandhi. Scottish Churches College was strict in forbidding anti-government propaganda, but the students were sympathetic to the cause of home rule. Although there were no open signs of rebellion, students sometimes held nationalistic meetings in secret. When Subhash Chandra Bose urged the students to support the Indian independence movement, Abhay listened. He liked Bose's faith in spirituality, his enthusiasm and determination. Abhay wasn't interested in political activity, but the ideas of the independence movement appealed to him. This Subhash Chandra Bose, he's the one that actually led the Indian National Army later. You always see statues of him all over in India. Like that. And then, of course, Mohandas Gandhi. Like that. Many Bengali speakers and writers expressed India's drive for independence, Swaraj, as a spiritual movement. For the nationalists, political emancipation was analogous to the soul's liberation from material bondage. Abhay was interested in devotional service to Lord Krishna, the absolute truth, a conviction he had imbibed from his father and maintained since his childhood. Whereas Indian independence was a temporary, relative truth. But to some of the leaders of Swaraj, while admitting that the Vedic scriptures were indeed absolute, asserted that the original glory of Indian culture could not shine forth for the world's benefit until India became free from the stigma of foreign rule. The foreigners, they pointed out, blasphemies and castigated the preeminence of India's culture. And so that we see is that most of the people in the independence movement were trying to reestablish or wanted to reestablish India's culture, the spirituality, study of the Vedic literatures and all that. But then the difficult, yeah, so their idea was is that you India's glory couldn't shine forth because the British were always speaking badly about it and advertising in that way and, you know, in this way trying to make it look like it's something lower and that their culture then is very special and much higher. So then the idea that these persons would speak, though they were, you know, spiritually minded individuals, but they were generally in most cases, except for Subhas Chandra Bose, they were religious, but they were more political than, how you say? Spiritual, right? And so, but at least then the element that they were pointing out is if India's culture could be practiced and followed, people could see the glory of India. Problem was is that when the independence actually was established, then the people who were more politically inclined or purely politically inclined, they became the prominent. So then the difficulty came up is that then India became secular instead of being, you know, trying to establish the culture. They tried to, you know, how you say, maintain the Western culture. But instead of the British managing it, they managed it. So all they changed was who was in charge of India, not that the culture of India would become prominent. Right? So that was a... It didn't work out so well, let's say. Abai had felt this also in his assigned reading in M. Ghosh's England's Work in India. He'd encountered the theory that the Vedic scriptures were impure, recent writings, and that India had been a spiritually backward culture before British rule and the spread of Christianity, right? If they're saying it's a more recent writing, then you have the element of recent writing it's like, how old is the New Testament in Christianity or the Quran, you know, that's only even 700 years or something. So recent writings is not the point. Whatever the time is, if something is absolute, then it's always good, no matter when it was written. But here, in any case, they were trying to say the Indians were backwards before the British came in, simply because maybe they didn't have a train or a car or a gun. But as far as culture went, then, you know, so much more. There were many British insults against the Shastras, such as Abai's professor trying to discount the law of karma. But if India could gain national freedom, then everyone, not only Indians, but the entire world, could benefit from India's highly evolved Vedic culture. The call to Swaraj, although covert, attracted virtually all the students, and Abai amongst them. He was especially interested in Gandhi. Gandhi always carried a Bhagavad Gita. He daily read Lord Krishna's holy words and spoke of being guided by the Gita above all other books. Gandhi's personal habits were pure. He abstained from all intoxication, meat eating, and illicit sex. He lived simply, like a sadhu. Yet he seemed to have more integrity than the begging sadhus Abai had seen so many times. Abai read his speeches and followed his activities. Maybe Gandhi could carry spirituality into the field of action. The Gita's truth, Gandhi proclaimed, belonged in a most prominent place, where the Gita not only could be read, but could work for everyone's freedom. And the symbol of that freedom was Swaraj. Right, so the thing is how many, so basically one sees from historical that, you know, Prabhupada mentions that Gandhi was a saintly politician, like that. So he was more politician than saint. But in any case, he was very committed to the principle of the Bhagavad Gita and that culture being prominent. So he was a bit surprised himself when actually independence came And then the whole thing actually became sidelined by others who were just pure politicians and had no interest in, you know, religion or India's culture. So he himself was a bit disappointed. But that's generally the nature of these things. You have to be very, very careful, because the medium you use also gives that result. So Prabhupada also went preaching through the spiritual, preaching then the culture, and then it's established not on the political basis. Like that. Does that make sense? So you have to be careful of what medium you use to establish whatever you're trying to do. Like that. It's like, Nationalist sympathies at Scottish Churches College remained underground during Abai's years as a student. It was a prestigious school. A student had to study very seriously to obtain a degree there, and he could then look forward to a fine career. To speak openly against British rule and in favor of independence meant to risk being expelled, to lose education and career. Only the most rebellious would dare. So the students met undercover and listened to the revolutionary readers. We want Swaraj, we want independence, our own government, our own schools. Gaur Mohan watched his son with concern. He saw Abhay not as one of the students of millions of instruments meant to change India's political destiny, but as his pet son. His first concern was for Abhay's welfare. While world events moved across the stage of history, Gaur Mohan concentrated on his son's future as he hoped it would be, and he always prayed it would be. He was planning for Abhay to become a pure Vaishnava, a devotee of Radharani. He had taught Abhay to worship Krishna and be pure in character and had arranged for his education. Now Gaur Mohan thought of getting him married. He was, you know, it's like, okay, all these things are very nice, but then, you know, it's his son. So he just wants to see that everything goes well for him. Because the Swaraj, okay, it's a nice thing, you know, you establish all this, that nice. But the point is you want to make sure that the individual's, you know, going all right. So naturally then his father's worried more for that. His son's going well, his devotional career, and all that, so, yeah. According to the Vedic system, a marriage should be carefully arranged by the parents, and it should take place before the girl reaches puberty. Gaur Mohan had gotten his first daughter married in her 9th year, his second daughter at 12 years, and his third daughter at 11. When his second daughter was going on 12, Rajani had said, "I shall go to the river and commit suicide if you don't get her married at once." I was 14 when I was 12. In the Vedic system, there was no courtship, nor was the couple allowed to live together during the first years of their marriage. The young girl would begin serving her husband by cooking for him at her parents' house, and coming before him to serve him his meal or by taking part in some other formal exchange. Then, as the boy and girl grew to physical maturity, they would become so lovable to one another that they would be inseparable. The girl would naturally remain faithful to her husband, since she would have no association with any other boy as she grew to puberty. Yeah, so much of the time the process of marriage and attachment or affection is very much misunderstood. Devotees in the past have arranged marriages, and some have done, you know, thought about it very well, arranged them very nicely, they go on very well. Some would do it not necessarily so nicely, and others would even do it for, you know, convenience for the temple or for the preaching and this and that. So they wouldn't necessarily be taking into consideration the individuals. So in this way, then, much of the time, things would have a difficulty, things would go wrong. There was no support for the couples. There was no people that was explaining to them or trying to help them through understanding, you know, how to behave in Krishna consciousness within a marriage. And so then, for some people, they have the idea that arranged marriages can't work, can't be good, right? You have to go out and figure it out yourself, right? Some profess this very strongly, like that. Well, you know somebody?
I know a few people.
Okay. Why are you laughing? But actually it's a misunderstanding, because a few points. One is on arranging the marriage, that aspect of it. So we'll take it in two parts, one the affection and one the arrangement. The arrangement then, because one is attracted or attached, what is generally the way that you look when you're looking for these things? Right, people generally go by what they look like. Right, so you can have a boy or a girl that looks very nice, but they may not be trained at all, may not be cultured at all, may not be responsible at all. Right, because marriage means that it's going to. You want to say something?
Yeah, just on that. What you were just saying is that you see in the Vedic,
loudly.
In the Vedic times, when there's two paramours that don't know each other.
Uh-huh.
They're always hearing about the beauty, but they're also always hearing about the qualities.
Ooh, that's a good point.
They fall in love on that.
On the qualities, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I understand that. So even in the Vedic time, if someone themselves became attracted, like Krishna, Rukmini was attracted to Krishna. Usha and I think Aniruddha, or Nala and Damayanti. So, but they hadn't seen them. They heard about their good qualities, like that. So it was the qualities that attracted them, and then on top of that, they look good. You know, so that's like it's a plus. You know, like that. It's like the meal. What's the most important thing? It looks good or it tastes good? Okay. Now, what if it tastes good and it's prepared nicely and it looks good? Then that's even better, no? But if it only looks good but doesn't have any taste, then? So that's the point why you never make an arrangement on a marriage by looks. Right? Because the looks aspect is only as deep as, you know, three layers of skin. And basically what you're looking at is the outside layer. You know, and depending upon, you know, the skeletal structure and the muscles and all that, then you stretch the skin over that and then you say it looks nice or not. You understand? Very important that to understand this point, because how long does good looks last? Right? Because you have to live with somebody. You're not living with their good looks, you're living with the person. Right? So therefore, the qualities are the most important, right? Then on top of that, of course, then one should feel comfortable and like this, right? But that's the next thing, because when the qualities are strong enough and compatible enough, then one will find that beauty. So that's why then the second thing, how do you develop attraction or attachment, let's say? Attraction's one thing, attachment's the main thing. Because attraction gives a basis for a relationship, but it's attachment that actually maintains the relationship, right? Does that make sense? Attraction means potential. Attachment is need, right? So if there's a need, then it continues. If there's no need, then it won't continue, right? Does that make sense? So now, there is either the natural attraction or attachment that's there, you know, like that. Occasionally you find that. But otherwise, the main thing, as we see here that's being pointed out, is that by the exchange in service, by the exchange in their duties, that is what actually develops the deep attachment. Right? If it comes naturally, great, but means that was already there. So this idea you have to be with the person, live with the person, be around the person, do things with the person, to see if it'll work, that's not this first principle of natural attraction, because that you wouldn't have to, you'd already know, You know, Rukmini already knew Krishna's her man. Right? Nala and Dami, they knew that each other was the thing. Because they heard the qualities, that's what they wanted, they were naturally attracted. Right? Does that make sense? So attachment had developed just from hearing. It wasn't just interest. Oh, it looks attractive. That sounds good. So let's find out. So now if you're going to try the element of checking it out, let us just analyze checking it out. Okay? Because checking it out means the attachment's not there. There's just potential. Right? So now you have two systems. You have no formal structure for it. Just whenever and however you can get together, you spend time. Right? And how are you going to spend time? Cleaning the house, moving the furniture around, you know, washing the dishes. Is that, you know, you're going to go out for a walk, going to go to the Puchkawala, you know, this and that, you know, of course, because you're the...
If they're lucky.
Yeah, if they're lucky.
If they're a little in the
mode of goodness. Or, you know, trying to be spiritual, so you sit down and read a little bit of, you know, something, you know, Krishna book or something together, Bhagavatam, you know, like that. Lasts for about a week, so... That or, you know, something in the house where the mom is around and, you know, the reason the mom's there is not to chaperone and just stay in the background, see everything's all right. The mom wants to make sure that she's also getting a taste out of the thing and part of the whole scene because she wants to control the whole thing because who knows if it's going well in her life. You know, so all these different kinds of things. So then you see is that it doesn't have any structure. So can you tell? Because if one's married, that's not how it works. Marriage means it's two people cooperating together. They have a plan in their life and they go through it. Therefore, we see here is this Vedic system is, yes, they get to know each other, but through formal situations. You know, a girl's cooking, serving prasad to the boy. It's her serving prasad, not the mom over in the back trying to start up a conversation and show that she's still got it, you know, even though she's 40 years old and shouldn't worry about these things. You know what I'm saying? So that's not how it works. We see it, so one is in unstructured, but then marriage means it'll be more structured. Or the other is because marriage will be structured, therefore get to know each other through a structured, actual, real-life situation. So now if you look at that, then it looks pretty absurd that modern persons would profess this system that ends up in 75% divorce rate. And still they profess it.
That's the fun part.
You know, this is another one, you can put it on your list of most amazing things after everybody dies, everyone knows everyone's going to die, but then they behave as if they're never going to die. Like that. So this can also go on that list. Right? So we see before, in India, it was very rare, extremely rare, that a couple would find it difficult to work together. Very rare. So that means something was correct, something was going on. They've been doing it for thousands of years. And the only difference is that they lose the faith in that and try to use this modern system. Not that the old system won't work. Old systems always work, right? You know, 2,000 years ago, the Romans would take a potato, put it in water in a pot, on a fire, boil it, and the potato would get soft. Amazing, isn't it? Shocking, no? That things didn't change?
Like magic.
Yeah. You know, how is it that it happens, you know, like that? You know, and even then, it was also another shocking point, is that they could take a metallic object that was very thin and sharp on one side, and by pressing it on top of the potato with some force, you know, it would actually cut the potato into half. You know, how is this going on? You know, it's like, you know, believe it or not, you know. You ever believe it or not? Yeah, you know, so it's like, huh?
Ripley's
believe it or not. Yeah, so you know what I'm saying? And you want to know what's really far out? Really, really far out? The Romans used to breathe, you know, air. You know, it's like that. You know, it's not just a modern thing. like that. But don't tell anybody. They used to also drink water. You know, they get thirsty and stuff like that. And nighttime, they get tired. They lay down, go to sleep. You know, they lived in houses. They had apartment buildings like that. Caesar lived in a 7-story apartment building that his mother owned, like that. And people from all over the world, you know, at the time of the Roman Empire lived there. So, like that. They took rent, you know, there were taxes. They had roads, you know, windows. Isn't that amazing? You know, so it's like, if you go on the list, they had everything that people have now. Okay, they didn't have an iPod. Yes, that is true. But they had live musicians. So that's the thing. iPod, live musicians. iPod, live musicians. You know, which would you rather have? In the evening, you want to hear some music, so your own personal family live musicians come out and play for you. Stuff like that, so. Yes?
There's also one point that
attraction, yes.
Is that, I mean, generally speaking, it's not, it wouldn't always be so, pretty much most of the time. You're attracted by something that's obvious. The energy is there, that looks good, and you know, whatever. But you notice those boys or girls who have good qualities, they don't exhibit those things. So that's, if you're attracted to something, then you may want to question.
Yeah, you understand? Can you hear back there? No. Okay, so making another point is that on the first point we're making on attractiveness, just on physical attractiveness, if that's the basis, so then if somebody's physically attractive, much of the time we see it's because they feel they're attractive and they're putting out an energy of that. Well then that's what's external you can see. So there's not necessarily any qualities other than being attractive that they have. So there's not necessarily much substance there. It's not based on qualities. You know what I'm saying? Well, somebody who has good qualities, much of the time, they're not trying to make themselves look attractive to the public. They'll be attractive, but they won't be attractive in public. Does that make sense? So therefore, if one is, how do you say? If somebody is attractive in public, one might question on, are there any good qualities? Does that make sense? Like that. So one has to see one's being, because otherwise it means a lack of training or that in public they're being attractive. It's another thing by their qualities, then they're containing and all that, and the qualities make it outstanding, that makes attractive. That's another thing, because if the qualities are so great, they do shine forth, they are attractive. But you'll see is that they're not, that they're hidden behind shyness, or, you know, being reserved, or being cultured, or being gentle. Does that make sense? So if that's the face, is that shyness or that gentleness, but it's still very effulgent, very attractive, that means you're looking at qualities, right? But if you're looking at it, the attractiveness is simply, you know, so much manifest energy and spunkiness and this and that, then that's not so good. Does that make sense? So that would be there all the time with girls. Right? If you see them in public, formal or informal, and it's too wild, you know, like that, that's not a very good sign. Boys in a formal situation, the temple, then it should be culture, they shouldn't be too much energy. But on their own, if they're sitting over with their friends, then they might be a little bit more spunky.
It's like hardwired in men, of course, that even though you're saying that one girl may be very, very attractive, because they understand that look at their energy, then it's not like a flamboyant, maybe, or like extroverted. And then another will maybe be attractive also, but it's that they're giving off that energy. That it's hardwired in a boy that he knows that when he looks at a girl with the energy, the possibility of getting something is there. But even though the other girl may be just as, if not more attractive, it's hardwired that oh, well, I'm not really going to get anything there, so, you know, it's more of like an appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Options or possibilities.
Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. You hit here? No. So, so then the point is that it's just natural that person that is very seemingly attractive, you know, externally, because of manifestation of the energies, there's the idea that it's very easy to get something that you want, right? Because they're already putting out so much energy, that means then it's much easier to, you know, you could take it and direct that wherever you want. But someone who is more cultured and is reserved in that energy, even though as attractive or more attractive, there's the idea that one would, it's not going to be so easy, one would actually have to work. So there'd be an appreciation, right? So if we're looking at from the untrained, we might tend towards what looks more easy. But the point is that rasa is based on appreciation. You know what I'm saying? Because any relationship, appreciation of the shanta rasa is the first stage. Then from there it builds. So if there's only attractiveness, it doesn't mean that there's appreciation. Right? So if there's no appreciation, there is no rasa. So going back to what we said before about the Vedic system of making these arrangements and developing these, attraction and all that, then the principle is that if there's no appreciation, then you won't have a relationship. You can't. Attraction's not enough. You understand? So it'll only turn into attachment if there's appreciation. So rasa is based on appreciation, at least emotional rasa. Sensual rasa is based on what you see, right? What you can, you know, in other words, what the senses are going to interact. But actual, as people, then it has to be based on emotion, which means there has to be appreciation. From appreciation, then there's service. So like you see here, there's appreciation. The marriage is arranged. Then there's service. They deal with each other in an environment of service. So them serving each other is the first stage, not trying to be, hang out and enjoy. It's service, right? Because that's what's going to last. You understand? Every day in the house, there's going to be food and there's going to be, you know, eating. It's not that every day it's necessarily going to be exciting and happy. One day it's happy, one day it's not happy. One day it's happy, another day it's not. But food will always go on. Service will always go on. Everyone doing their duties will go on. So if a relationship is based on duties and this and that, you actually have a relationship here. You understand? You understand this presentation? It's not a matter of we're saying this is the rule or this is faith. You have to have it, or being good, you have to do this. What we're saying is, this is science. A relationship is not there if there's no appreciation. And you appreciate qualities. Right? You live with qualities. You understand? So that's science. It doesn't matter what your belief is or what your culture is. It's still a science. Okay, so we have to take this seriously, right? So that means the first thing to do is develop qualities, right? You want to, in the future, get married, have a family, then you have to develop the qualities to do that now. And, you know, how you say, running around, killing each other, harassing each other, making each other's lives miserable is not the qualities that make a marriage work. Does that make sense? Yeah? Anything else? What do you think? I mean, was I wrong? Does some of you know? I just want a husband who, you know, can harass me and annoy me and just make my life miserable. That would be so nice. A self-centered, conceited, you know, just disgusting jerk of an individual. That's the perfection. Right? Yes? Yeah, but good looking. Yes? No? Okay. So. Mohan Das, Gaur Mohan, had many friends in Calcutta with eligible young daughters. And for a long time, he had been considering a suitable wife for Abhay. After careful consideration, he finally chose Radharani Datta, the daughter of a Suvarna Varnik family associated with the Mullahs. Right, so it seems that the Mullahs, the Duttas, the Deis are all one group. Radharani was 11 years old. After the meeting between her father and Gaur Mohan, both families agreed upon the marriage. Okay. Although Abhay was a third-year college student with no income, it was not uncommon for a student to marry and would have no immediate financial responsibilities. Abhay didn't appreciate his father's choice of a wife. He had thought of marrying another girl, but in deference to his father, he put aside his reluctance. For the time being, he was living with his family and she with hers. So his marital responsibilities of supporting a family would not be immediate. First, he had to finish college. So here, that, yes. How old was Prabhupada at this time? Yeah, something like that.
Because he went to college at 16, so third year.
So third year, okay. So, yeah, so then like that, 19, she's 11. I always thought it was when they married, she was 11, he was 22. But by what you're saying here, yeah, then it would be there. So then, there's an 8-year difference. Like that. So then here, because she's very young, and he's going to school, so then they're both still, they're married, but they still stay at each other's, at their own houses. Like that. And then they interact, you know, on formal situations and things like that. But that way, then, the girl doesn't have to worry, you know, about being taken care of. And the boy also doesn't have to worry. He just focuses on his studies. She focuses on her own education, her own development. And then it works very nice. During his fourth year at Scottish Church College, Abhay began to feel reluctant about accepting his degree. As a sympathizer to the nationalistic cause, he preferred national schools and self-government over the British institutions. Therefore, Bhaktivedanta National School. See, coming in line here, probably like national school. Sorry, not international. National.
We have nothing against international. We're not affiliated.
No, but we don't affiliate with international or national. But that's interesting, yeah. National school, that can be their quote, right? Yeah. Right there. He preferred national schools and self-government over the British institutions. But he could see that as yet no such alternatives existed. Gandhi, however, was calling on Indian students to forsake their studies. Right? The guy is a lawyer, and he's telling him, forsake your studies.
He might have even studied in England.
He studied in England and all that, yeah. He was a, you know, I think he was a barrister even. And then he went, I think he was from South Africa, so he was visiting South Africa. And, you know, I guess he was a, you know, high roller, so he had a ticket on, he had a first class ticket on the train. And so he's riding on the train, and then he gets thrown off the train because Indians don't get to ride first class on the train. So they actually physically threw him off the train. And
that's
so that's when they started the... Yeah, I mean, you know, in other words, they should be careful who they insult, because then they started a whole movement that eventually brought down SA, you know, India first and then SA, you know, and so it was, you know, from the British side, then they, that's the thing, they're such good managers, but they're so insensitive.
Very sentimental.
Very sentimental, yeah, and this and that, and, you know, very much into their own, like this, support of their own. You know, so they there's some good qualities that are there, but the problem is they're so insensitive to those that they rule. You know, instead of making me, so the Vedic law is that you take over another country, than those laws of that country which are not against the Vedic principles or those customs, then you make them law. It means people have to follow them. You know, it's just like in some countries, they have their own established system of education, but they allow for alternative education. So if we come up with a Krishna conscious alternative, they'll study it and see if they feel that it actually is, you know, education, the children will actually get educated. They'll approve it. Then they'll come along. They won't use their standards for judging if your school is running well. They'll use your standards or our standards. And they'll come along and saying, you're saying the kids will be able to, you know, learn verses and this, and they'll come and test. They'll come and see, are the kids actually learning Bhagavad Gita verses? Do they know the philosophy? You know, are they learning, you know, the culture and this and that? And if they are, then good, the school's doing nice. If they're not, they'll you know, chastise the administrators of the school and say, you're not following what you said you're going to do. Understand? So that is that would be the Vedic standard. It's not against the principles. So therefore, you know, it's made law. So, but they would go in and just whatever they want, what was good for them economically, because that was the pure basis of their rule, was economics. Then they would be inconsiderate. And because of this, one could say they were great managers, but they have lost, I think, practically every country that they've ever conquered and ruled. Every country. I don't know if there's any left that they... Well, maybe Falkland Islands, right? There's some islands down there that I think nobody lives on. You know? They, like that. But otherwise, where there's people, I don't think they control anything. There's like 60 countries in the Commonwealth or something. That means they've lost 60 countries. So you can't call that good management. And why? Because they're insensitivity. If they're such good rulers, no one minds good ruling. But the problem is that we have another few minutes. But because of their insensitivity, their ruling can't last. So due to the lack of culture, same thing, lack of culture, like we were saying in the marriage, lack of culture, then it doesn't succeed. Just like if there's a lack of culture, the marriage won't work. So if there's a lack of culture, management won't work. Right? If there's a lack of culture, education, any of these higher things won't work. Does that make sense? You even have to have culture to do business. Like that. Successfully. You know, as a long-term thing. Does this make sense? Yeah? No? What do you think? Yes? Okay. Gandhi, however, was calling on Indian students to forsake their studies. The foreign-run schools, he said, instilled the slave mentality. They made one no more than a puppet in the hands of the British. Still, a college degree was the basis of a life's career. Abhai weighed the choices carefully. Right. How much is like Gandhi was such a leader. Now, how much of that was him himself or that what he was and that he's given it all up? I guess if he was that clever, it doesn't matter where he'd be from. Yeah, yeah.
But that he might not have had the technical know-how, the system, and how it works.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like that. Gormohan... Gormohan didn't want Abhai to do something he would later regret. He had always tried to plan the best for his son. But Abhai was 23. Okay, so that means it may have been... No, he was 22 at the time. So, because I had heard Prabhupada said he was 22 and his wife was 11 when they got married. And would have to make the decision for himself. Gormohan thought of the future. The horoscope said his son would be a great religious preacher at age 70. But Gormohan did not expect to live to see it. Still, he had every reason to accept the horoscope as accurate. And he wanted to prepare Abhai. He tried to plan things accordingly, but there was no way to guess what Krishna would do. Everything depended upon Krishna, and Krishna was above nationalism, above planning and the laws of astrology, and above the desires of a modest cloth merchant aspiring to make his son a pure devotee of Srimati Radharani and a preacher of Srimad Bhagavatam. Right? Yeah. Although Gaur Mohan had always allowed Abai to do what he wanted, he had also carefully guided him always on the path he knew best. Right. So this is the point, is that if you're giving those freedoms for the purpose of them, one, either that means out of affection, two, for them to develop their own ability, but it has to be based on good guidance. Or you just allow the child to do whatever they want and there's no guidance, then that's not parenting. You understand? Because parent means teacher. Right? Just like the teacher is parent. They're supposed to guide. They're the first guru. Mother's the first guru. Father's the second guru. Then the teacher is the third guru. Does that make sense? So that means they're the guide. So if they're not guiding with something that's solid, then how do you make a decision? Right? Does that make sense? If they haven't trained you nicely in what are all the formal beats and how to play them in what situations, then how are you going to decide on your own what beat to play in the bhajan? If I just hand you a madanga and say, play, whatever you like, you play. You know, you understand? What are you going to play? Nothing. Does that make sense?
The djembe.
Hmm?
The djembe.
The djembe, yeah, that's... Yeah, that would work. Okay. So we'll hear tomorrow, does Abai accept his degree or not? Will Gaur Mohan be satisfied or aghast at his decision? Tune in tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada, Lila Rita. Same place, same plug, same station. Jai. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you.